This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings.
A very warm welcome to This Is Money in Share Radio podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm Georgie Frost. Joining me in the studio is editor Simon Lambert and deputy editor Adrian Lowry to round up the week's top stories they've been covering on their financial website of the year. And what a week. Hard Brexit, soft Brexit, well, just scrambled Brexit. The High Court threw a spanner into the works of Theresa May's plans to get the ball rolling on the UK's divorce from the EU.
This case was very much about protecting our parliamentary sovereignty.
I think, actually, it's a bad day for democracy.
It could delay things, of course. Speculation about a general election is always with us.
Forget what this means for the country. What about Mark Carney? After much speculation this week about the future of the Governor of the Bank of England, that unreliable boyfriend committed to stay on for another year until 2019 to guide Britain through Brexit. But if the process is all delayed, then what then? Not everyone, though, would like to see him stay after some rather dire pre-vote warnings.
This is a man who politicised the Bank of England, provided some very dire forecasts in the event of us voting to leave. Personally, I would have preferred if he'd left far sooner.
He's going to have his critics. He's staunchly defended the rate cut that they made post the Brexit decision.
And this was the week that the Bank of England admitted the economy was perhaps doing a little bit better than expected. We had Super Thursday. Was it as super as the name would suggest?
Perceptions of job security remain strong. Wages are also growing at around the same modest pace as at the start of the year, and confidence is solid.
Right, hey, so interest rates kept on hold. The bank expects inflation, though, to almost triple next year. More pressure on families, more woes for savers. Two-thirds of savings accounts paying less than inflation. So what should you do with your cash? Stick, twist, overpay on your mortgage, perhaps? Or how about premium bonds celebrating its 60th birthday this week?
Buy premium bonds, win something really worth arguing about.
But wherever you put your cash, remember, it sounds too good to be true.
People think they are cleverer than the last person that got scammed and that they won't get scammed, and they know the difference.
There's mounting pressure for a government crackdown on cold call scammers, and
it's my first day as a guest interface representative. I'm using a neural network to review the most common ways of greeting customers.
So could we see a post-work future as robots take over our jobs? Which got me thinking, a somewhat tenuous link here. What job have you done that you would quite happily have had a robot take over? A very good morning, Simon. A very good morning, Adrian. Lovely to have you back in the studio. Simon, to you first, what job would you very happily have handed over to a robot?
Making cardboard boxes. I basically did some temp work either just after I'd finished school or while I was still at school. And basically, I spent days making cardboard boxes. So there was the flat cardboard box template, and I had to stand there, unfold it, fold it up to make the cardboard box. I think it was for a clothing company.
I don't know why you went into finance journalism.
At the end of the first day, my hands were just covered in these evil paper cuts. At the end of the second day, they were even worse. And then fortunately, after the end of the second day, I managed to get myself moved slightly up the ladder and was instead picking clothes in a warehouse, which was pretty dull in itself. And I used to basically amuse myself by deciding that I needed to get the clothes from the highest possible level and climbing up the racks in the warehouse. It was dullsville.
We do what we can to entertain ourselves.
Not only would I have preferred if a robot had done this job, but the robot would have almost certainly done a much better job than I did.
Touché. But on a more day-to-day basis, what job are you quite happy to have a robot take over?
Do you know what would be really great is if a robot could actually properly sort out your email. Email is the bane of modern existence, isn't it? We get so many of them. I think I probably get 300 a day, something like that. If they could actually properly sort it out, sift the wheat from the chaff and just identify the ones you need to read. Because the problem is when you get so many emails, it means that you actually miss the ones that you need to read. You do your best, but you miss the ones you need to read. And people say, oh, well, you know, just divide it into a certain number of times a day or folders or whatever. Basically, I could spend my entire working day just doing my emails and I wouldn't do any other work, so yeah.
I think the future's coming with that one, though, Simon. A very good morning, Adrian, for you. What job have you done that you would have quite happily have handed over to a robot?
I made the mistake of answering an advert in the Manchester Evening News when I was looking for some spare cash in between sixth form, I think, and university, and it said that I could make a lot of money in this easy
right.
sales process. And I ended up driving around the suburbs of Manchester in a small van with somebody else. And in the back of the van were all these paintings of ships, tall ships, clippers, that sort of thing. And we had to go and try and sell them to pubs. So we'd kind of walk in, we'd park up in these, you know, I'm from that part of the world, and but there are some, I don't know, some parts of Manchester that aren't that salubrious on the around the outskirts, and some of the pubs aren't all that welcoming. And you know, we'd get out the van with these pictures under our arms and go in there and try and convince them that it was just what they needed for.
So, Adrian, you're telling me you answered an advert in a paper offering lots of money. You were in a van with someone else with paintings in the back trying to sell them around dodgy areas of Manchester. Right. Did you do a background check, Simon?
A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Frost. You're listening to Share Radio, the team from the finance website of the year, This Is Money, are back in the studio with me for our weekly catch-up in partnership with NS9. I'm joined today by editor Simon Lambert and deputy editor Adrian Lowry to go through some of the stories they've been looking at this week. And what a week it's been. It began with all eyes on that most unreliable of Canadian boyfriends. Would he commit to the very English old lady of Threadneedle Street? And what would he say about the economy? Then our attention, though, was somewhat diverted by a small High Court matter over some such minutiae as constitutional law, democracy and the like. Here's our reporter, Tim Jones.
Judges say the government does not have the right to trigger Article 50 without consulting Parliament.
Parliament did not vote for the people to settle this by referendum. It said that this referendum will be advisory only, and it's for Parliament to decide, having given the rights under the European Communities Act, whether it's going to remove them or not.
That's David Green, a lawyer for the campaigners who brought the action. They say June's referendum isn't binding. Trade Minister and Leave supporter Liam Fox is not happy.
The government is disappointed by the court's judgment. The country voted to leave the European Union in a referendum approved by Act of Parliament. The government is determined to respect the result of the referendum.
But Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn thinks it's the right outcome.
Well, Parliament has to have a say in this. These are crucial decisions for the future of this country. It could delay things, of course. Speculation about a general election is always with us.
While the man in charge of taking the UK out of the EU, David Davis, just wants to get on with it.
Parliament voted by 6-1 to give the decision to the people. And that's why we are appealing this to get on with delivering the best deal for Britain.
The government will try to overturn the ruling at the Supreme Court in December. Downing Street says the Prime Minister still intends to trigger Article 50 by the end of March.
Well, forget the country. Could the ruling scupper Mark Carney's plans to Brexit in 2019? The Governor of the Bank of England agreed to stay on a year longer this week. Lots of speculation in the press in order to guide Britain through the choppy Brexit waters. Not everyone, though, his biggest fan.
It is a privilege to do this role, and I'm a servant of the people of the United Kingdom, and it would be an honour to be a citizen of this country.
Circumstances change, he changes. Actually, he's been absolutely fundamental in making sure that we continue to grow rather than move into recession.
This is a man who politicised the Bank of England, provided some very dire forecasts in the event of us voting to leave. Personally, I would have preferred if he'd left far sooner.
I mean, he's long been seen as the unreliable boyfriend, hasn't he? He's going to have his critics. He's staunchly defended the rate cut that they made post the Brexit decision. It's a difficult one because obviously there's two different arguments whereby they act sooner rather than later, so you sort of head off the potential for an economic meltdown of loss of confidence in the UK economy. So looser monetary policy would help to sort of stabilise that. So there is an argument to say that. I don't necessarily think that that has been the case. I think the improvement in the UK economy has generally been seen due to the loss of value of the sterling. And I think it's storing up problems further down the line. And obviously the rate cut is not going to help that with inflation coming likely to be next year, but it's likely to be fairly significant.
Market analyst at Hantech Markets, Richard Perry at the end there. Well, the bank had to concede this week that perhaps some of those dire Brexit predictions were a little bit overstated. We had Super Thursday, inflation forecast hiked, interest rates held. Mr. Carney admitting it was down to the economy's resilience since the UK's vote to leave, upping the growth outlook.
Perceptions of job security remain strong. Wages are also growing at around the same modest pace as at the start of the year. Credit is available and competitive, and confidence is solid.
Well, goodness me, there was a lot in that, Simon. Wasn't that just your average week, I guess, in post-Brexit vote Britain? But let's start, shall we, as the week started. Lots of speculation about the controversial Mr. Carney, whose face has graced more front covers, I think, on the newspapers this week than all of the past Bank of England governors put together. Are you pleased he's staying on till 2019? Give us some more. Why is he so controversial? What's going on?
I actually think that Mark Carney does a decent job. So I actually think that it's quite good that he is staying on. I think probably the last thing that you want to be doing in the middle of a time of uncertainty and instability is losing your central bank governor. I think you need a decent hand there steering you through. And he is a decent hand. He knows his onions. And he's made the effort to try and do lots of explaining to the public of what's going on. Now, I think the reason why he's got people's backs up is because of some of the things that were said before Brexit, where he said, he basically warned that if we voted to leave the EU, then we would see instability. We could potentially see, you know, a fall in house prices,
a
fall in the pound,
recession,
a technical recession and things like that. Now, some people think that that was politicising it and it was the Bank of England stepping in where it shouldn't have stepped in, telling people that they should vote Remain rather than leave. I don't necessarily agree with that. I think that as the governor of the Bank of England, the Bank of England's job is basically to maintain monetary and financial stability. And I would say that it is fairly obvious that maintaining the status quo is more likely over the short term to maintain stability than not maintaining the status quo. And I think that if you look at, you know, what the Bank of England said in that light, then it's fairly obvious why it was said. Now, obviously, some of those predictions of things being really bad immediately after Brexit haven't come true. Some of the predictions of things being worse after Brexit in the long run might come true. But you don't know. We said this before the vote, that these are just predictions. And the problem with predictions is you can make your best guess about what you think might happen, but at the end of the day, anything could happen. I don't think nobody predicted, basically, before Brexit that what would happen is 3 months later, the stock market would be up by a load. They predicted the pound would fall. The pound did fall. The housing markets had a bit more momentum than people thought, but it did dry up immediately afterwards. But we always said that we thought that the thing that would cause the housing market to slow was probably more to the fact that houses are really expensive and a load of buy-to-let purchases had been pulled forward at the start of the year. So I don't think that he should be as controversial as he is, but there's been a lot of focus on interest rates over the last 5 years. And even, you know, longer, going back to the financial crisis. But over the last 5 years, it's been this question of shouldn't we be getting them up? Shouldn't we be getting them up? We never managed to get them up. And we had to take them down before we could get them up. And I think Carney probably looks at it sometimes and wonders what on earth he got himself into.
Adrian, your thoughts on that?
I think it's worth pointing out also that, and I think Sam's entirely right, in that actually yesterday wasn't so much of a climb down as you might think, or as it's made out to be. In fact, the overall impact on growth that the Bank of England estimates up to the end of 2019 is slightly worse than the 2.5% impact that they predicted in the August inflation report.
Just remind us, Adrian, what actually came out of yesterday in terms of Super Thursday? What exactly the Governor of the Bank of England and the Bank of England said about the economy, interest rates, inflation?
They said that growth this year will be a lot better than they thought, that next year it will be slightly better, but then in 2018 it's going to be considerably worse. And in 2019, it's going to be worse. And over that whole period, the impact on economic growth will be slightly more than the 2.5%, which they estimated in the August inflation report. At the same time, they said that inflation is going to exceed its 2% target in spring next year. It's going to peak at 2.8% in early 2018. All this is with a range of error, obviously, and it's going to stay above 2.5% well into 2019.
Keeping up, lots of facts and figures there. But, I mean, the general, it doesn't really matter in terms... I mean, I suppose it does for lots of people, those very minute details. But up, down,
in, out, left, right, I mean, economic forecasting, yeah. They're always revising it. Yeah, what is the point?
Yeah, no, sure. I mean, I think if you could sort of sum it up easily, he's saying, OK, we've had this kind of resilience, which we didn't expect, and they've been proved wrong by the short-term resilience, but, you know, we're not out of the woods. There's going to be a big impact on household disposable income through this increase in inflation because wages aren't going to keep up. UK households will start to feel it in 2018-19.
Well, again, like Simon says, so much uncertainty, and we got even more this week. I wonder how much, Simon, you reckon a spanner in the works is this decision by the High Court for both the economy and for, indeed, Mr Carney's position, given he said he'd stay to guide Britain safely out of the EU, may not be as soon as we thought. I don't want you necessarily to get into all the nitty-gritty political issues around this, the constitutional aspects, sovereignty, all of the like. Briefly, if you would, the idea of this High Court decision, what now for this and what is it going to do for the pound in our pocket, quite simply?
Well, I mean, to be honest, you look at this whole Brexit thing and it's just a shambles. It really is. From start to finish, you think, gosh, if we could turn back the clocks, wouldn't it be nice to remove this problem? But I think the issue is that what it looks like is a very messy divorce that has three people. You've got the Leave vote, which basically is like, we're leaving. Mm. You've got the other side, which is the EU, which is the side that we're leaving. And then you've got the other side, which is the Remain campaigners, campaigning for us to not do what the referendum said and remain anyway. And I think that there is, within that, there are two camps, OK? There is the camp that actually thinks that we might possibly be able to kick this into the long grass and never actually leave the EU. I know a sizable number of people who seem to be labouring under that perception that we might be able to do that, right? Everybody has friends on Facebook, on Twitter and things like that. And I have a surprising number of them who basically seem to think that we could somehow overturn the referendum result and just not leave the EU. OK, I don't think that's how democracy should work. You ask the people a question, you give them a vote on something. And the question was, should the United Kingdom remain a member of the European Union or leave the European Union? Now, you might not like the answer, but you still have to abide by the result. Now, the argument that lots of those people put forward is that the result shouldn't stand because everybody was lied to in the run-up to the vote. And there was an awful lot of misinformation being kicked around. But there was an awful lot of misinformation on both sides of the argument, right? And the side of the argument that lost was probably putting out as much misinformation. The Remain side was probably putting out as much misinformation as anybody else. And it should have been able to win it because it had the government and the Prime Minister and everyone on its side. Mm-hmm. So I think it's very dangerous to start saying, well, look, you know, we should just ignore this result because this result doesn't count. But then in the other side of this argument, you've got the side that says, well, we shouldn't basically be doing this without Parliament having a say on how we do it, right? Which I can see the argument for that. But the problem is that the way that we're meant to leave the EU is by triggering this Article 50 thing. And according to the EU's rules, the official way, that's the official way to leave, and you can't have any negotiations about how you might leave the EU until you trigger Article 50. Now, what's been pointed out by people who are basically professional negotiators is that actually you would be mad to ever trigger Article 50 without having any negotiations first, because you instantly put yourself on the back foot in the negotiations because you've got this 2-year limited time period. So really what you want to be doing is negotiating first. Now, I think that basically what the government were hoping for was that they would be able to have some kind of conversations with the EU, not official negotiations, but some conversations behind closed doors. This is the kind of thing that we might find acceptable. What would you find acceptable? This is what we want to do. This is what we don't want to do. And the EU has turned around and said, no, basically, we're not having any conversations, you know, in the same way that the Brexit means Brexit thing has been said over here. They've said Brexit means Brexit as well. These are the rules. Now, if anybody had any common sense in this situation, what they would say, basically, our government and the EU would say, put their heads together and say, you know these rules about leaving the EU, right? This Article 50 thing, where we're not meant to negotiate until we've triggered it, but nobody's going to want to trigger it without having any negotiations first. Clearly, this thing doesn't work. Nobody's put it into practice yet. Actually, now we've tried to put it into practice, we can see that this doesn't work. So for the benefit of everyone involved, the EU and Britain, in the idea of finding a mutual solution that is a good mutual solution rather than an ugly divorce-style mutual solution, why don't we just say, look, this rule doesn't really work properly, does it? Should we see if we can revise this in some way? But nobody seems to be able to take any common sense in this situation. And so now you've got the scenario where we've had this vote, and the vote is that we shouldn't be able to trigger Article 50 without it being going up before Parliament. But you've got the problem is where there's a suspicion that the majority of MPs would vote down leaving because the majority of MPs wanted to remain. So you've got a 52-48 referendum on one side to leave, and then you've got MPs who probably overwhelmingly want to remain on the other side. But then are individual MPs going to vote against their constituencies? Are they going to feel they're going to get deselected? And you essentially have the makings of a bit of a constitutional crisis. But the thing is like all this stuff should be expected. We're going to see so much more of this stuff over the next 2 years. Even if we invoke Article 50 without it going in front of Parliament, we're going to see tons and tons and tons of this stuff. This is only the beginning.
Which is exactly what Mark Carney said. This is just a bump along the road. Do expect there to be many more. But wasn't the point of the judges, aren't they just to interpret the law? Wasn't it better that perhaps we went to court to dot the I's, cross the T's and make sure finally something is done, I suppose, properly on this Brexit decision so that when it does go through, which nobody seems to be, am I right in thinking this will go ahead, that when it does, no one will be able to come back and say, well, actually, it didn't go through the proper channels.
Yes, well, that's what everybody's been stressing who are in favour of the legal procedure. It's a constitutional issue. This is what the legal precedent says, and if you're a strong believer in UK democracy and the parliamentary system, etc., as a lot of people who voted Leave would say that they are, then you have to abide by its rules. And if its rules mean that these three judges throw a bit of a spanner in the works, well, then it's kind of tough, really. But their argument then is that these judges come from a part of society that is out of touch and predisposed
well,
to...
Well, that's surely an argument for another issue as to how we like our judges to be. I think practically as well, though, where are we now? What is this going to do? What impact? Because we don't like this uncertainty, and this is just creating more uncertainty. So what's going on? And also, why is this being led by an investment manager?
Well, so she's campaigning.
She Gina likes Miller.
She's a campaigning investment manager.
Right.
She's her and her husband, who used to be a fund manager, who have campaigned against fees in the fund management world and active fund management. Interestingly, her husband is a former active fund manager who made an awful lot of money from active fund management. And they've done some good work in that campaigning against fees. I think the issue with Brexit, basically, that has highlighted the problem is that basically, if you're going to play a game, it's generally a good idea to decide on the rules of the game before you start playing the game. What we appear to have done is played a game and then started making up the rules after the event. And I think that it sort of shows that maybe we should have put quite a bit more thought into this referendum and into explaining to people exactly what would happen in either scenario. And I think it exposes the fact that this looks a bit like it was done on the hoof.
Sadly, though, this is
not
a game,
and to be honest, I don't think the EU's behaviour in this entire scenario, talk of having to make Britain suffer for leaving and things like that, is exactly the kind of thing that made lots of people vote to want to leave the EU in the first place. The EU has shown itself up over the last 15 years to be a pretty terrible political organisation attached to initially what was a noble idea.
And in terms of the economic and financial impacts, I mean, let's bring to no illusions, the markets have signalled their displeasure, not so much with Brexit, but with the uncertainty. 110 euros to the pound, I don't think that's going to change for 3 years.
Didn't the pound go up, though, after this ruling?
It was not after the ruling. Yeah, it was after the ruling, and it was also after the Carney speech, because that changed the bank's rates outlook from sort of negative, i.e. the next move is likely to be down, to neutral or up. So now the Bank of England is saying, in light of the new inflation forecast, the next move for interest rates is probably going to be up, or you know, they're going to stay the same for a long time. So that's a positive for the pound, a kind of, well, not slightly unexpected positive for the pound. So yes, it did. It'll be back down again soon, back to where, I mean, you know, it went up marginally. I don't think our holidays are going to be getting any less expensive any time in the next 2 or 3 years. And the evidence is that businesses are worried as well. Households are the only constituency so far that aren't worried. Consumer spending's strong. It remains to be seen how long that holds up.
I mean, the inflation report is this big document that comes out, this big PDF kind of thing. And I must admit, as proper interest rate and inflation and economy geeks, we love the inflation report. You know, it rolls around every 3 months. It's like, woohoo, look through, look at all the charts and everything like that. But the foreword is always worth reading. And it's basically, yesterday's was about 800 to 1,000 words of, yeah, we don't know either. Basically, you could have they could have literally just written, we don't know either.
The other
interesting thing to come out of it yesterday was, you know that phrase where they say two wrongs don't make a right? Mm-hmm. Well, the Bank of England did this interesting thing where it admitted it was wrong, but then said it had made the right decision to cut interest rates in August, although that was for the wrong reason, and that actually turned out to have been the right thing to do. So I don't know how many wrongs and rights there are in that, but somehow, if you add all of those together, it ends up with the Bank of England being right.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Editor Simon Lambert, Adrian Lowry.
This is Money. Brought to you in partnership with NSandI.com, helping you keep on top of your savings whenever, wherever.
A very warm welcome, Editor Simon Lambert and Deputy Editor Adrian Lowry of This Is Money, alive in the studio with me to go through some of the stories that they've been looking at this week. And with record low interest rates, inflation set to soar, those with cash savings may be forgiven for thinking, well, what is the point if you are fortunate enough to be in that position? What should you be doing now? You have research from Money Facts that suggests 403 out of 635 savings accounts already pay less than inflation, meaning millions of prudent families are seeing their nest eggs eroded by rising prices. Well, here's independent personal finance expert Simon Reed.
To my mind, I would be just happy that I've got this cash and not worry about the fact that it's been eroded by inflation because, you know, we're so far away from actually beating inflation. If you've got some time, if you've got enough money, then you would be starting to think about maybe putting some money into a higher paying account, such as a cheque account, some current accounts, pay more on cash savings, you know, and look into different ways around this, maybe looking at P2P. There's lots of different things you can do with your money. But in the main, I would just say to savers, look, you're lucky you've got some money, suck it up. You know, just keep your cash safe. You're going to need it.
Suck it up. He also advised there putting it into current accounts. But we had the big blow this week, didn't we, of Santander dropping rates on its 123 account to 1.5%. Is it time the government steps in and helps out savers? And if so, what should they do? Well, we'll explore the option of paying off your mortgage early shortly. That is, of course, one option. But first, Simon, this is exactly the issue you've been addressing in your minor investor blog. Just give us some context, though, of the environment that we're in and, indeed, why you wrote that blog.
Well, the environment we're in is that basically savings rates have been falling yet again. In fact, savings rates have been on a downward trend for many, many years now. But the real big fall in them has come since the summer of 2012 when the Funding for Lending scheme was launched, which is basically a way of bunging cheap money to banks and building societies to then try and get them to lend out more money to borrowers. Mm-hmm. And it essentially removed much of the desire from banks or building societies to take your money in as savings because they could get this cheap money from the Bank of England. Now, a version of that was revived again in August when the Bank of England also cut rates to 0.25%. So we'd seen rates on hold at 0.5% since they were first cut to 0.5% in 2009, I think. Mm-hmm. And then before they ever managed to rise, they were cut. So the effect of that has been savings rates have just been decimated again. And so we've seen the situation now where the Best Buy easy access savings rate, and that's the best one you can find, so if you actually bother to go out and find a good one, is at 1%. Now, at 1%, a lot of people just go, what is the point? And actually, if you look at legacy accounts, the ones that people are sat on where they haven't bothered to switch, some of them are paying like ridiculous sums, 0.05%, 0.01%.
How much are you getting for yours?
Oh, I got a letter from Barclays that mine was like 0.05 or something. Luckily, there's
Thank
no
money. Thank you for your loyal custom,
yeah,
Simon Lambert.
Yeah, it did. It blamed all kinds of excuses. All kinds of excuses from this bank. But, you know, I mean, luckily I've got no money in there. But so the thing is, you need to move your money to the best savings account. That's what we've always said to people is be active, move your money. But then you look at the best savings account paying 1% and you think, literally, what is the point? And now, unfortunately, inflation has also risen to reach 1%. So basically, if you have your money in your 1% savings account and it's being eroded at the rate of 1% a year by inflation, you're basically earning no real rate of return. Now, inflation is tipped to rise to 2.7% next year, or 4% by some people. And savings rates are not tipped to have a commensurate rise. So basically, you will now be losing money effectively on your savings. You will have a negative real rate of return. So that's a pretty poor situation to be in.
Would you like the government to step in and help savers, and if so, how? But also, would you almost like the Bank of England to raise rates?
Well, I don't think raising them in August would have been a good idea. I think raising them at some point before August would have been a very wise move. I think that actually what we've seen post-Brexit in terms of the economic resilience that Mr. Carney was referring to indicates that we've been far too cautious, and we probably could have raised interest rates a couple of times. In fact, I reckon that we could have maybe even got them to the heady heights of 1.5% without doing any damage to the economy.
What is the argument not?
The argument against that, that the economy couldn't possibly have taken 1.5% interest rates, that it would have been terrible for borrowers and businesses and all these other things. Now, if there is a school of argument, you know, creative destruction and all that, that says if people can't cope with a 1.5% interest rate, then they probably can't cope at all, and that you need to sort of take the poison out of the system kind of thing. I don't know whether I necessarily buy that, but I definitely buy that we could have got interest rates up from 0.5% at some point over the 7 years that they were sat there before we cut them again. So the answer to all of this is, what on earth do you do with your money? And the answer being put forward by a lot of investment experts is you should invest any spare cash that you have.
So, so investment experts saying that you should invest.
It's not. I did point out in my column that the person I refer to here, Michelle McGrade of TD Direct Investing, has some good advice for people. But obviously she was going to give the advice to invest because she works for an investment platform. But she talked about spare cash. But it's like, what is spare cash?
Well, absolutely, yeah.
There's people actually, people do genuinely ask this question, but what is spare cash? It's like, well, you need your rainy day money, okay? Yeah. So if your boiler packs up, or the clutch goes on your car, or you suddenly have some other household emergency, your washing machine, that strange noise it's been making, it suddenly packs up, you need some money to pay for that. Likewise, if, you know, something goes wrong, you suddenly lose your job or something, you need a bit of money to tide yourself over. Now, the amount that normally gets quoted is 3 months post-tax earnings, to which the response of many people was like, God, I wish I had 3 months post-tax earnings in savings, let alone anything above that to invest. And so there is this scenario where this question of, are you holding too much cash, is that classic thing that gets referred to on the internet as first world problem. You know, it's a very privileged problem to have, isn't it? Oh, I've got too much cash. But there are lots of people, of the people out there who do have some money, who do hold too much cash. So they've got their rainy day fund, and then when they add up all the other cash they've got, they probably, you know, have lots of it extra just sitting around in savings accounts, premium bonds, things like that, that aren't earning them much of a return. And they could be making their wealth work harder by investing it. But then, you know, there are some other good reasons for holding cash as well.
So why aren't they, Adrian? Why aren't they investing it? What's going on?
Well, I think there's it's a bit of a step, isn't it, to go from somebody who might not even know that much about savings to start investing in the stock market. And they'll have to go through a process of self-education in order to do that.
This Is Money, of course.
That's right.
Lots of information on there.
However, there are other ways to use any surplus money you may have at the end of each month. Sorry, first to go back on the rainy day fund, I think quite probably now one of the best ways to hold your rainy day fund, whatever it is, a few thousand pounds, £4,000, whatever, is just to kit in premium bonds.
Which we'll get onto later. Yes.
But they are probably, you know, from what's out there, it might well be the best option. And if you've got anything else left over, then there are several options. There's the investing option. Mm-hmm. There is overpaying your mortgage.
Yes, tell us about that, because you've actually investigated this on your website, the idea of paying off your mortgage early. Not something, though, that lenders have traditionally tried to encourage.
They don't make it easy. The best of them allow you to overpay by 20%. The more usual is 10%. Mm-hmm. I mean, in my case, that's 86 quid.
Is this monthly?
And so it's not a huge amount. If you think that that is something that you might want to do, the other way of doing that is the more formal procedure of an offset mortgage, which would mean remortgaging. And that is something where you hold your surplus funds in a sort of savings account, which is linked to the mortgage, and it the amount of money you have in there reduces the amount of the mortgage, which then reduces the interest payments that you're making on that mortgage. Mm. And if you're paying 2.5%, 3%, 4%, that's the interest that you're saving. So instead of making 1% on a savings account, you're saving 4% interest. Yep. So for a lot of people, actually, at the moment, in the current environment, offset mortgages might make a lot of sense.
Finally, so get your calculator out.
Yeah, exactly. Get your calculator out. And finally, let's pay it to your pension. You know, maybe we are talking, as Simon says, about people sort of in the upper income brackets, in the middle to upper income brackets. Probably the two things that they could be doing at the moment is, you know, think about an offset mortgage and pay more into their pension, or maybe going on holiday.
Going on holiday, yes, indeed. It's a nice one to end there. But in terms of pensions, quickly, you can overpay, though, can't you, again, on that one?
Oh, yeah,
you'd
absolutely.
You'd have to have a lot of money, though,
yeah.
wouldn't you?
Yeah.
You can pay, I think it's £40,000 a year now is the annual allowance, which, and the lifetime allowance is £1 million, mm-hmm. which seems like an awful lot of money to most people. But there are scenarios where you could accidentally bump up against that, mm-hmm. where, for example, you have... you've been working for a company for a long time and you have a final salary scheme, which would be worth a lot of money, or you are a particularly high earner, or the money that your company's putting in takes you over. So if you're someone who's got a big pension pot, or you are a particularly high earner, then you need to maybe watch that one. But for the vast majority of people, they ain't going to be facing that very nice problem to have.
And it is a nice problem to have indeed. But we are speaking about what to do with your cash. Adrian just hinted there, one tried and tested option.
A thrifty couple, Sue and Sid, by budgeting once saved a quid. And happily they said,
that's fine.
The extra pound is mine.
No, mine.
Then premium bonds, their friends suggested, so they in same their quid invested. Then some months later, what a fracas, they found they'd won 5,000 smackers. And gleefully did shout, that's fine.
It's mine.
No, mine.
No,
moral,
mine.
Buy premium bonds, win something really worth arguing about.
You can see why they're so popular, can't you, after that advert? Yes, the ever-popular premium bonds celebrated their 60th birthday this week. Since that first draw held back in 1956, 355 million prizes with a total value of £17 billion have been handed out. And around one in three adults now hold the investment, or 21 million, with over £63 billion worth of bonds. Here's Chris Dowsett from NSNI.
Premium bonds are a form of savings product, a little bit different from other savings products on the market. It's a bit like having a risk-free flutter, I suppose. The minimum investment in premium bonds is £100. It used to be a pound back 60 years ago when they were on sale. The investment limit's gone up a little bit, but the format of the draw is still the same. There's a monthly draw every month. The prizes range from £25 tax-free to £1 million. And we find that a lot of people up and down the country have invested in premium bonds. One in three adults in the UK have premium bonds, so they've always been a popular product. And we've given out 355 million prizes worth £17 billion. Now, obviously, the prize fund has changed over the years, but we are still paying out over 2 million prizes each month. I think premium bonds are a bit of a national treasure. We've been urging people to tell their premium bond stories, and in fact, many, many customers can go online to our website and tell us about the stories that they've had, whether they were given bonds as children or bought them on the first day and still have them to this day. Small wins, winning big prizes, sentimental value of some of their bonds that were perhaps given by their grandparents. There is a myth that only big investment limits win the big prize. That's not always the case. We had somebody a few years ago, they had £17 in premium bonds. They scooped the £1 million jackpot. When we got there to deliver the good news, the for sale signs were up. They were about to sell their house. We told them the news that they'd won the £1 million, and it changed their life because it meant that they could stay in the house that they'd been in for so long, and quick as a flash the for sale signs came down and it made a really big difference. So there's lots of reasons why people love premium bonds, going there 60 years and still going strong,
a national treasure no less. Chris Dowsett from NSNI there. Adrian, you brought up the subject of premium bonds. Have you ever won anything? Have you got some?
I have always had since I was a baby. I think I got bought some as a christening as a christening present by some friends of the family. I don't know if I've still got those, actually. But I've held some and sold them and sort of kept a few and ups and down. Because the thing is with premium bonds, their sort of viability or how much they make sense as a savings product, it tends to vary. It varies according to what other savings accounts are like and also what the prize fund is doing. So at the moment, I think the average rate of return, i.e. if you have average luck... mm-hmm. and you win an average amount of prize money in the premium bond draws, then the annual rate of return is 1.25%, which, as we've been hearing, is slightly higher than the best savings account that you can get at the moment. Then you're also in the draw. You know, you're in the draw for, is it £1 million prize now?
Two a month, I believe, is it not?
Two, sorry. And then, you know, various other smaller prizes, and everybody likes to be, you know, in there for the prize, like the lottery or whatever. However, you know, if you don't win anything, then your deposit is going down with inflation. So it depends how lucky you are, really. But, you know, in the light of the savings market at the moment, apart from regular savers, which is the other thing I was going to say is worth considering, anybody who's with a bank that has a decent regular savings account that can pay 5 to 6%, then, you know, the premium bond's worth looking at.
Actually, Adrian, you raise an interesting point there, because in terms of Ernie, Simon, as much as 53.9 million in premium bond prizes has not been claimed by rightful winners. So, Adrian, you might be a winner.
Well, there you go. So,
why not?
Because Ernie is busy. Not only does it have to do the premium bond prize, it also has to be the fastest milkman in the West.
That's true.
So, basically, there was a great column written about premium bonds. Now, I've got premium bonds, OK? I've got quite a few of them. I probably have too much of them. I should probably be investing some of that money, like I said about earlier. But there was a great column written about premium bonds in the Investors Chronicle by their columnist, Mr. Bearble. And I Googled it just now. I don't have the whole thing up here, unfortunately, because mm-hmm. I've got to log in and I can't remember my login. But it's one of those things that you read and you think, I wish I'd written that. So basically, I'll read you this, OK? But he actually went through and looked at all the prizes that he'd won from the premium bonds and, like, had he had better than average luck or worse than average luck. And actually, over recent years, had better than average luck, right? Which he pointed out should then theoretically mean mm-hmm. that the best thing you should do is cash out. Because if you agree with the theory of reversion to the mean, which is one that's generally accepted...
Which is most people obviously thinking that.
If in, like, over the last year or two, you've won more than you should have done, so your rate of return is 2.5% or 3%, then basically what you should do is sell out, because reversion to the mean says that in the next couple of years you're going to win less than you should do, so that you go back to that average level. But just to look at the odds of winning big prizes, this column says, it's one of the great mysteries. What did Mary and Joseph do with the gold those nice old men gave them when they were shacked up in Bethlehem? Imagine they'd use some of it to buy the maximum number of premium bonds. All right, I know that's not possible, not least because premium bonds were only introduced when Harold Macmillan was Chancellor of the Exchequer in 1956, but this is an illustrative exercise. The point is, after 2013 years, and on the balance of probabilities, Mary and Joseph would still be waiting for their first £10,000 prize. Sure, they should have bagged a £5,000 prize some time ago, certainly by the time of the Black Death was plaguing Europe. As for a 10,000 gold nugget, that could still be 600 years away. And realistic prospects of anything bigger? Forget it. Now you really are talking miracles.
One day you'll write something of that mastery. Yeah. One day. Editor Simon Lambert, Deputy Editor Adrian Lowry.
Sharing ideas about money. This is Share Radio.
Now, we've spoken about the impact of rising inflation to the pound in your pocket, but there is a much more menacing threat we need to watch out for. Cold callers, more than 10 million pensioners are targeted annually, many of those calls coming from fraudsters, and there are calls for the government to take action. Here's personal finance expert Donna Ferguson.
It's absolutely essential that they address it, or at least, as this, you know, I think a helpline which is properly funded, a bit like the Money Advice Service, which is a website funded by the government, so that you can go to an independent place. You can basically go and get proper advice from a trustworthy source. And I think that does need to happen with some sort of pensions helpline. People think they are cleverer than the last person that got scammed and that they won't get scammed, and they know the difference. You know, even my dad, he's 78, and he sort of thinks that he can sort of joke around with cold callers because he's aware that they're just trying to get money off him. But I worry that he could get sort of sucked in and end up actually thinking that they have something worth buying.
Well, that was Donna Ferguson there. So a petition's been launched demanding pension investment cold calling be made illegal, attracting the support of former pensions ministers Ros Altman and Steve Webb, no less. Simon, briefly, what's going on here?
Well, basically, there's this problem of people calling people up and suggesting that they should do certain things with their money in order to get better returns.
Which some people might be surprised is not illegal already.
No. I mean, you can ring someone up and say, would you be interested in this? Mm-hmm. Now, the problem is that these can be buying car parking spaces at airports, investing in holiday villages in South America. There could be all kinds of things. And there are rules around the kind of investments that you can promote to people and how you promote them. But they can be quite difficult. And by the time they normally catch up with people, it's too late and people have lost their money. Now, this suggestion that's been put forward is basically just nip this in the bud, make it illegal to cold call anyone and suggest a pension investment. Then you won't stop people doing it. They will still do it. Mm. But by making that illegal, it makes it much easier to just simply go after them. You don't have to prove that the investment is dodgy. You just say, well, you cold called these people and we've got these logs that say you did it and that's illegal. You're in trouble. And there's a lot going for that argument, to be perfectly honest. I think it's a very sensible one because realistically, no reputable firm will just call you out of the blue and say to you, oh, we've got this really good investment for your pension. They just don't do that. So if anybody does call you and do that, put the phone down.
Do indeed. Now, imagine a world without work. It sounds ideal, doesn't it? Just think of what you could get done, or indeed what you couldn't get done. We picture months spent lying on beaches, passing whole days in the garden, endless hours to practice our hobbies and spend time with our loved ones. Well, the dream could be a reality, and indeed a bit of a nightmare, with many jobs already being lost to better technology and automation. So the rise of the robots, this is what This Is Money have been looking at, already seeing the impact. Where? How much of a danger is this, Adrian, do you think? Lots of books we can read about it?
Well, we're seeing it in our own, not exactly our own industry, but there's this recent development in financial advice over the last year or two is robo-advice. Mm. You know, this idea that you can feed your statistics, your sort of financial situation into a program, a financial advice program, and that can sometimes give you, you know, sort of as good a rundown of what you should be doing with your money as an actual financial advisor. I think, you know, the jury's still out on that, but there's no, you know, particular reason to write it off. But this idea that I think at some point in the next few decades we'll all be sort of lying on chaise long eating grapes while a robot sort of shuffles around doing our ironing is probably all that, doing the job that we were previously doing, you know, to keep ourselves in money. It's probably a bit unrealistic.
Well, some might be, but however, some may not be. Are there any jobs? I mean, could we have a robo Simon Lambert editor of This Is Money or a robo Georgie?
This idea was punted forward a few years back, actually, probably like going back about 10 years, I seem to remember. Not the idea of a robot Simon Lambert or robot Georgie. No, but I remember reading about this idea of basically sort of robo-journalism. And they did it with sports reports. There was this company that reckoned you could basically take the sports report, take what happened in the game, and you could write the sports report.
Yes, they did.
And I remember reading one of them, and it looked like it had been written by a robot. I mean, that's not to say that I haven't read some stuff that's been filed to me in the past that looks like it's been written by a robot.
What you talk about with that robot report, I read exactly one of them, and one report was written after the death of, I believe it was a baseball pitcher, and so it was all lots of tributes. But of course, the robot didn't know that, so it sounded like a really callous article. And I thought, don't worry, Simon, your job is safe.
Yeah, but I think the issue is going to be for people who are doing jobs that can be replaced by robots. So you're looking at things like anything ranging from factory work to like lower level like admin work and things like that. And the problem is how do you deal with the increased productivity from having those robots do that, but then also the fact that people need to be earning a living unless you go down the French route of basically paying people to go and water roundabouts on a large scale. But there is this problem, and I think that we have, as a human race over the last 100 years, demonstrated that we've not been particularly good at using the extra productivity we've gained to give the individual more free time. I mean, Keynes famously wrote this thing about how basically he dreamed up this world of the future where we'd be working 15 hours a week, and that world of the future is right about now. And the last time I checked, I wasn't working 15 hours a week.
No, quite.
Editor Simon Lambert, Deputy Editor Adrian Lowy, thank you so much for joining us.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings.